Warning, the Stone Age Gamer includes a lot of bad language. Cover your mother f***ing ears.
Good evening and welcome to episode 231 of the Stone Age Gamer podcast for the week of December 7th, 2018. I'm Chris Randazzo and with me tonight is, as always, actual government official Dan Ryan.
That's for real. That's weird.
After a scheduling snafu on my part a few months ago, I think, we are finally rejoined by the great Brett Weiss.
Hey, guys. He is for having me on. Appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Thank you for coming on.
I would say the very good Brett Weiss, not the great Brett Weiss, but I appreciate the, appreciate the intent, you know, the sentiment.
The fair to Midland Brett Weiss.
Yes.
I'm nothing if not enthusiastic. He is here to discuss his new book, his next book, his old books, and whatever the heck else we feel like talking about. But before we go any further, here is your weekly reminder that you can email us at mail@geekade.com. Just include the words Stone Age Gamer in the subject line. You can let us know what you think of our show, what topics you would like us to discuss in the future, or just say hello, because we always want to hear from you, the listener. So, Brett, how the heck are you? How have you been since last you were here?
It's been a kind of a whirlwind year. I've been to a lot of video game conventions. A lot of organizers have had me out to do autographings and set up a booth and do panels and all that kind of stuff. So that's been kind of fun. Since I'm not, you know, like some popular YouTuber or something, it's kind of nice that, they respect the quality of the work and the books and everything enough to have me out anyway. So it's been a lot of fun. And it's been kind of crazy. Been traveling all over. And right now I'm actually between books. I finished my 10th book, the SNES Omnibus, the Super Nintendo and its Games, Volume 2, N through Z. I wrapped that up recently and it's at the publisher. It'll be out April 28th. But for the first time since 2006, I don't have a book currently in the works. So I've been kind of chilling out with my spare time lately. Been playing some Spider-Man on the PS4. That's been great.
Oh, it's so good, isn't it?
It's amazing. The feel of it's just kind of fun wandering around the city, just swinging around, checking things out, and the missions are fun. The fighting is really good. You know, there's some strategy involved. You know, there's some beat 'em up stuff, but you got to use strategy. You know, there's some stealth. There's some. The webbing is really crucial to your battles, you know, not just getting around. So it's a great game.
Just fantastic. Like it is by far the best Spider-Man simulator that there has ever been.
Yeah. I remember being blown away by the original Spider-Man on the PS1. And of course, you know, Spider-Man 2 on the PS2, everybody likes. I remember, you know, being excited about Spider-Man for the Atari 2600.
Right.
Of course, there's no fighting in that game. And it's because before fighting was really a thing in video games, you know, there was Activision's boxing. There was a few games, you know, where you would fight some, but they were sports mostly. And, you know, just it probably never occurred to the programmers of Spider-Man for the 2600 to have them actually fight, because it just kind of wasn't a thing then. But
yeah, it was really more about
seems crazy, the top
of building, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy climber type of game, but
yeah, it really is. Like there's not much to it except like get up here and like, oh, there's Green Goblin. Whoa, no! All right, never mind. Yeah, by the window, we're good.
Yeah, it's like shouldn't they fight? But you know, it's hard to imagine that now. But fighting just wasn't a thing, you know, in games back then. So Chuck Norris Super Kicks is one of the first games where you fought, and people just. It was just a rarity in gaming.
Well, I mean, an experience like it was.
The 2600 port of Double Dragon, like, yeah, it's technically very impressive, but, you know, fighting with a joystick and one button is not.
Yeah, and that was great. Much later than, you know, it was a few years after Spider-Man, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Out,
so, yeah. But we didn't even have a PlayStation 4. My son recently got one, and so I've been. And having a good time with it.
It's a nice system. I recently got my very first PlayStation 4 as well.
It's very sleek.
It is
very sleek, and I like the Spotify and the net access to. You know, it's just all well laid out, and it's convenient to use, and the controller has a good feel to it. And so I'm very impressed so far.
Is yours a parallelogram?
It's kind of a slim It's a slim model.
Okay, cool. I mean, I've seen all these different pictures, but I have no size relativity for them because so I got the my PS4 in the mail and I took it out and I was kind of surprised at like it's kind of a square, you know. I think I have like the first gen model of it.
Right.
And it's just this super nice looking, very deep parallelogram thing.
You have the one that's like matte on one side and the super glossy on the
yeah,
other.
Yeah, and the
right?
super cool yeah. blue stripe in yeah, the middle yeah, when yeah. you turn it on.
Yeah.
It's really, really quite nice. But yeah,
I like that the controller has a light on it too, and it's just kind of neat. But yeah, I've always loved the dual analog sticks. Going back to the PS1, just been a big fan of that that model.
It is a very, very nice controller. It's a very nice system too. I wish I was able to spend more time with it.
I don't remember the last time we talked, Brett. Is that the only like current gen console you have, or do you have a Switch as well?
Well, when the Switch first came out, Nintendo actually sent me one.
Oh, that's what it was. Right. Right.
Yeah, with a couple of games. So, because I was doing, you know, holiday gift guides for the newspaper and stuff. And so Nintendo was sending me tons and tons of stuff. And as a matter of fact, just within the last few months, Nintendo has changed their policies with reviewers. They have stopped sending stuff unless you request it. Now, they may send some stuff to the very biggest of the big, you know, Game Informer or whatever. And I've heard this from a lot of YouTubers, too, that Nintendo is not nearly as free. I mean, they were sending me every DS game that would come out. They were sending me, you know, the Switch stuff and codes and physical media. They sent me a 3DS XL. They sent me a ton of stuff. Well, that suddenly it just stopped appearing, so I contacted them. And they said you have to ask for things you want individually and tell them, you know, where the review will appear and all that stuff. And I even did some of that, and they haven't been all that responsive.
Yeah, I mean, they've been coming up with so many leaks. It's just all this stuff is just getting out. And I know like Nintendo World Report, they're a pretty big website, and they didn't get a review copy of Smash or anything like that. There's just a lot of that going around.
Yeah, and it's a shame they weren't a little more selective on who they took off the list and who they didn't, because I know a lot of really popular YouTubers, you know, were you know, advertising a lot of, or not average, but, you know, showing off Nintendo stuff they'd get or reviewing it or whatever. And the paper that I write for, you know, has a 200,000 subscriber base, which means there's a whole lot more readers than that. And right. Plus a pretty strong online presence, so... It's a shame they stopped doing that, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's what it is.
Yeah, nothing I can do about it.
It's not like Smash isn't going to sell itself.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, like, it's... Tiff and I were talking about this the other night of, like... So, we're 5 months away from Avengers 4.
Mm-hmm.
And there's supposedly a trailer coming this week. But, like, how awesome would it be if they just didn't? If, like, they just didn't put a trailer out for Avengers 4, because everybody's going to go see it anyway, just like everybody's going to go buy
Smash. So it would be like, the anti-tease.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Just put the title up and say the date and say, yep, deal
that's
with
it.
It.
That's
be a marketing it. Endeavor worthy of Andy Kaufman. You know, that would just be.
Oh, my God. It would be brilliant. And it would be. Yeah. It's such a baller move, too. It is such a line in the sand. Like, go ahead, other studios. What do you got? We don't even need to spend a dime on this because Nintendo doesn't need to spend any money on Smash. Is there anybody who's like, oh, I don't know what that is?
Well, you know, you think that, but then you see Pepsi and Coca-Cola commercials and you're thinking, why did they bother? Because everybody knows about it. Everybody drinks it. But first,
well, I mean, I suppose, but even with that, like, there's a little bit of a, you know, I saw like a cool Pepsi commercial, so I'm going to go buy a Pepsi instead of a Coke, because like you're either a Pepsi or a Coke person. Really, like, but I mean, maybe there's those few, like, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of my ass.
Well,
but, like,
I think
I'm a Coke person.
Maybe it's for the casual moviegoer that might get out of the house to go see the movie, you know, whereas they might say, well, I'll just wait for it on DVD or I'll see something else. Who knows? Maybe all that marketing is aimed at the, you know, the casual.
I mean, it's, I don't know. It's aimed at my mother-in-law, who is still very, very confused as to why Batman has not shown up yet. Iron Man. When is that going to happen? It's never. Sorry.
Did you guys see the new Captain Marvel trailer?
Did
that,
yeah.
Dude? I shed a tear. Not gonna lie. The her story to hero, like, shed a tear. This is what happens when you have daughters.
Right.
Does that mean I'm a bad father? Because I didn't shed a tear.
Yes, that means you are a horrible, horrible father, Chris.
I mean, I thought it looked awesome, but I didn't get teary-eyed about it.
Terrible.
There's maybe this ongoing... picture of a man, Chris.
There's been this. I want to get some input on this. There's been. I'm sorry, this is so little to do with video games, audience, but
we'll get to it.
So there's this ongoing argument between my wife and this other guy that she works with, where my wife is of the mind, and I'm totally on her side of this, that any sort of female action star or superhero in particular, like, they should have their hair pulled back, because why wouldn't they have their hair pulled back? Your hair is just always going to get in your face. And then this other guy's just like, yeah, but it doesn't look as cool. And she's like, I'm not talking about if it looks cool. It's just a matter of practicality. And so this guy has an obsession with Captain Marvel. Mm-hmm. And so the trailer comes out, and she's got the helmet thing that gets her hair out of her face when she's fighting.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, it appears and disappears. What is your thought on the whole, you know, hair pulled back or no situation as far as female action stars?
Well, I'm all for how it looks, because it's all pretty unrealistic. I mean, if you went purely functional, you'd have a very boring looking Wonder Woman. You'd have a really boring looking Catwoman. And you even, you know, Black Widow to some degree. Black Widow has more practical looking outfit, but still. Mm-hmm. I'm for, you know, whatever makes the girl look hot, you know, just to be perfectly honest.
That's fair.
So,
well, and I think that, like, because we are, like, it is a visual medium, and there can be, I think Captain Marvel is going to do a really good job striking that balance, because it does have the Mohawk helmet, which is a really dope look, and I'm really excited it's in there. But you also hired Brie Larson for a reason.
Yeah, they're not getting ugly women to play these roles. And
right.
Like, and if I want to see, you know, just ordinary looking people, I can just go to Walmart or something. When I go to the movies, I don't mind, you know, if the guys are buff or if the women are hot, or, you know, the hair, the clothes, the whatever, yeah, I mean, you know, if it's pleasant to look at, whatever, you know,
By that argument, like Thor, right? Christopher Hemsworth is a delicious looking man. I think we can all safely say.
He's not ugly.
No.
He is not ugly. That is a fact.
Not kick him out of bed for eating crackers. And he is an Asgardian warrior who doesn't have any armor, like, covering his arms.
Sometimes.
Because he's got really nice arms.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Captain America, like Christopher or Chris Evans. I don't know why everybody's so formal. Christopher Evans.
Seriously, Daniel.
Jesus. Christoph. Like, even in his portrayal as Cap, he doesn't wear the helmet much at all anymore. Because he's a good-looking dude, and you don't hire that dude to stick him under a mask.
Yeah, and like Paul Giamatti, you know, is an American Splendor. He's not in the Avengers, and there's a reason for that. And he's perfect for American Splendor.
It's because so he looks like the spitting image of Harvey Picard.
Yeah, so that's you know, I like small, intimate movies with plain-looking people that I can relate to, and I like big, larger-than-life movies that's all fantasy and glitz and, you know, muscle and tan and everything. You know, it's all good.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going for realism, watch UFC, because all the girls there, when they're beating the shit out of each other, they all got their hair pulled back. Because it does, it practically does make sense. But
yeah, it's like a cape. I mean, a cape would rarely be functional, you know, if you're fighting. It's going to, the wind resistance, yeah, and the people pulling on it to, you know, to capture you or whatever. Capes are impractical.
Yeah, I guess really the point with the hair thing is, I don't think Brie Larson is any less attractive with her hair pulled back. But same with most of these, you know, action type characters is like, I don't know, is Chris Hemsworth any less attractive with his hair pulled back? I think not. But again, he's Asgardian, so it could just be a cultural thing. I don't know.
But like, to bring it to professional wrestling, because I try to do that as much as possible. Lots and lots of professional wrestlers have long hair. Like, I think In the realm of jobs where the men have long hair, like, professional wrestling is probably like one of the top percentages. And the reason that they do that is because when you're selling, getting punched in the face or kicked or whatever, and you whip your head back in
animation,
the
animation, that's a good point.
It looks better.
Yeah,
it just does. Like, and that it's from a purely visual storytelling standpoint, it's inarguable that that does not add to the visual storytelling.
Right.
So, Brie Larson has to have her hair down every now and again.
It works for me.
You know.
Sure.
But then again, didn't Valkyrie in Ragnarok, her hair was back the whole time.
Yeah.
But she also didn't get punched a lot. And I would argue that Captain Marvel is going to do more fighting since it's her movie. She's going to be in it the whole time.
Did you know there's already like fan art for Nick Fury and the cat?
Yes. That's how he lost his eye. That's what they didn't tell you. That's going to be the scene at the end of the movie, is just that cat gouging Nick Fury's eye out. It gets very dark at the end.
Especially for Nick.
It's like, oh, look at you.
Maybe he loses his hair that way too.
Cat is vicious.
And it's not even a Skrull.
No. Well, maybe it is, though.
Maybe it is a Skrull.
Anyway, man, this conversation went weird in a hurry.
So video games, huh?
Notes.
Yeah.
So, but there's an interesting question, right? So with the Spider-Man video game, with the popularity of these things, I am honestly pretty surprised that there has not been a Captain Marvel game announcement. Mostly because this movie is going to do, I mean, it's a Marvel movie. It's going to do incredibly well. But if it does what they are projecting it to do, this is going to usher in a whole segment of the population, like, to have a seat at the table, right? Because, like, Black Widow's there and Scarlet Witch is there, but this is a female-centered...
There wasn't property. Really a Wonder Woman video game, was there?
No, and there wasn't a Wonder Woman video game. Property and with
but yeah. To be fair, this is all tying into the DC stuff, and that's been pretty shaky for a while.
Yeah,
but again, there hasn't really been a lot of the Marvel movie video games lately either, right?
No, there haven't. I mean, there were the Iron Man games back in the day,
like one and two.
I think there was a Captain America game.
I don't think there was.
There was a Green Lantern movie game, I believe.
Yeah, oh, like the
Green Lantern movie.
They've good really times. Dropped the ball, but even if it doesn't tie into the overall Captain Marvel movie, like this, there is an opportunity here.
Yeah, I mean the Spider-Man game doesn't tie into the multiverse, but just using those characters, it's a very good way to raise awareness for those characters and kind of bridge the gap between the movies and the comics, and you know, connect people towards that general vicinity. I guess the thing is that this Captain Marvel is a bit of an unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. You know, the Marvel movies can do no wrong, but I don't know how well the comics do. I assume they're doing at least well enough, but I don't know. I don't know how this one's going to sit. I don't know where this one's going to land. Is this going to be Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's like, here's this property that's like, you know, comic book fans know, but pretty much nobody else does, and now it's one of the highest grossing movies ever? Or is this going to be Ant-Man, where it's just like, yeah, that did really well. We're going to make another one of those.
So good too.
I don't know. Yeah, I really like both
Ant-Man. Ant-Man was good, and the sequel was a lot of fun.
Yeah, they were both a hoot,
phenomenal. But well, because like Marvel has the there's like a line of toys out now that's Squirrel Girl, and because there's a cartoon, I can't remember. It's like branded under
crap. It's Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl,
and it's really good.
Is it? Yeah.
But like Miss Marvel on that show references Captain Marvel like all the time. So
well, she's like her hero, right? I mean,
right.
That's why she's Miss Marvel, because she's who Danvers used to be.
But there. So I think there's a little bit more awareness of the property than there was of Guardians at the time when it came out. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say there is definitely more cultural awareness of Captain Marvel than there was of Guardians of the Galaxy. But I don't know.
would make a pretty
Black
badass video.
Black Panther was almost completely unknown among the general public, and that did pretty well.
Yeah, that did pretty well. That made a crap load of money.
Yeah. As well it should have.
Yeah, it was a pretty good flick. I liked that one quite a bit. But these characters would make for, especially post, you know, PS4 Spider-Man. Now, obviously, we've always known Spider-Man would make a good game, a solid game, and a fun game. But, you know, me and Dan just recently did an episode where we talked about a bunch of, Stan Lee's, specific Stan Lee's properties. And we brought up a lot of these different video game adaptations of comic book heroes. And there hasn't been a ton that have been done so extraordinarily right to the specific character. I mean, you've got the Batman Arkham games, which were very good Batman games. You know what I mean? And yeah. Spider-Man is a really good Spider-Man game. And even especially this one in particular seems to be really kind of taking that to the next level. So
Superman is probably the most egregious example. The vast majority of those games are awful. Now, the Atari 2600 one was groundbreaking because you had a storyline, you had multiple screens, you had adventure elements. So, and Death and Return of Superman for the Genesis and Super Nintendo were, you know, pretty decent Final Fight
beat
'em ups, games.
You know,
beat 'em ups. But
the Taito one is the best, the arcade one.
The arcade one's a lot of fun. And there's a decent one on the Genesis, but so many of the Superman games are just awful. And you think he would be the perfect character to translate to video games because of all his different powers and just the look and everything. But man, they've dropped the ball so many times. Superman for the NES is one of the worst games I've ever played in my life.
Yeah, that is not a good title.
Unbelievably bad.
I don't know that I've ever played that one.
You couldn't make a worse game if you tried. I mean,
Superman. I'm going to look it up while we're
just
while we're
some
talking.
Awful pudgy looking character that can barely even. I mean, it's so broken, it's pathetic.
X-Men was pretty bad too, though, on NES.
Yes.
Oh wait, I have played this. Yeah, it's
X-Men.
Awful.
Wolverine is awful on the NES.
Batman was great though, but not a great Batman game. You know what I mean? Like, it's not super Batman-y, but it was the NES. You couldn't really. Get
great
too much more into that kind of stuff. It was a great beat 'em up, great platformer.
Sunsoft
was so good back then.
This Superman game does have the most adorable version of the Statue of Liberty ever, though.
Right.
I mean, that is wonderful, but I think I played like 5 minutes of this when I was a kid and went, no.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
Kind of the trouble with a Superman game, though, is that, you know, how do you hurt him? You know, how do you put him in danger on a regular basis?
Well, you just create a more powerful villain like they did with Doomsday. I mean, it's all relative.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole game can't be just about fighting Doomsday, and you can't do the kryptonite cloud like did in Superman for N64.
Well, the EA one that they made to tie into the Brandon Routh game, it was an interesting idea of like you are Superman and you're doing all this stuff, but your life bar was the health of Metropolis.
That's right. That was a cool
idea like that, because that really is the only way to hurt that character, like
without kryptonite
and without it just being a ridiculous like a street thug punched Superman in the face and now I'm dead. Like, what?
Well, and a Silver Surfer for the NES, the fish could kill him. So I think he could probably come up with something that could face Superman.
That's a good point.
Everything could kill him. Jeez, we played for a while of Silver Surfer on the Pain in the Assathon this year, and
it's almost so bad. It's kind of fun, but it's so difficult and frustrating. But it's kind of interesting to play.
Yeah, it is. It's like it. It was one of those things. Like, I had a hard time putting it down for a while. I did eventually get frustrated, but it's like, it's not terrible. It's just missing that tiny bit of give that makes a game playable.
Right. So yeah. It's strangely compelling, but at the same time, frustrating.
Good music too. Yeah. Not a bad looking game. Really?
No, you know, not
bad looking. Well, that was fun. I want an X-Men RPG is what I want. And I don't mean like X-Men Legends. I mean, so X-Men's like my favorite comic book property. I just adore the X-Men. I would just love an old school Final Fantasy style turn-based RPG with the X-Men.
You think it'd be a natural?
It would be so good. It would be so good to fit in there. You could tell a really cool story. You don't have to abide by all the rules because you're doing turn-based RPG stuff. So it's already doesn't make any sense in reality. So you could have, you know, different party members and recruit all kinds of different characters with different moves and level them up and make them work together. And I just want Chrono Trigger with the X-Men. God, that would be so good.
That would be cool. I always wanted a Flash game that was like patterned after Sonic the Hedgehog. I always thought that would be really great. Cool. They had a
Master System one.
I have it. It's like an import for the Master System, and it's kind of a punch. You know, you punch and kick and stuff, but it's not really a fast game at all.
It's playable though, but it's not.
You know, it's not a fast game like I would like.
That was loosely based off of the TV series at the time, too.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Which, have you seen the promos for the Elseworlds crossover?
Heck yeah. I can't believe
he's back in that suit. That's so awesome.
Yeah, John Wesley Shipp. I posted about that on something about John Wesley Shipp on Facebook the other day about a picture I had with him. And he actually commented on the post. I thought that was pretty cool. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, our producer, actually, Evan, he helps run Garden State Comic Fest, and he's met John Wesley Shipp a handful of times. I believe his most defining thing about him that Evan came up with was that he smells really nice.
Okay, that's good to know.
I could be wrong, but I believe
that's better than smelling bad.
That's
right. Evan's just there behind John Wesley Shipp, like sniffing his hair. John Wesley Sniff. God.
So you've got this Super NES omnibus that's out,
and right.
Me and Dan both contributed to it, which was a lot of fun
and much appreciated by myself.
It was just a super fun experience, and I got the book. I bought it from you, I believe, and. I didn't go through Amazon. I was just like, Brett, give me book.
I appreciate that, man. It's a lot better for me if people buy them direct than through Amazon. I appreciate every sale, but direct sales are definitely better.
Yeah, that's how I typically like to do things. I bought I can't even remember which one it was. I was buying one of the video game soundtracks I wanted from a recent indie game, and I reached out to the developers like, which way should I buy this soundtrack that's best for you? And they were like, wow, that's a really nice question.
You know, I get that asked every once in a while, and man, I really appreciate it. That's very thoughtful because it does make a world of difference. I mean, authors get roughly, now I'm not talking about self-published books that are published through an actual publisher. The author gets maybe a buck or two per sale through Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with direct sales, it's obviously, you know, a lot more than that. So It's definitely a cool question to ask. Good job, man.
How is the book doing?
It's doing pretty well. It's selling very steadily. I'm not 100% sure it's selling well enough for me to take the time to do a Sega Genesis omnibus. I would love to do one. Maybe a single volume. I don't know if I would do two volumes again or what the publisher would want. But so far so good, but, it's too early to tell, whether I'll be able to, you know, just afford to be able to do a Sega Genesis, omnibus just based on how long it would take and on what the sales will be. So we'll see, but so far so good. Volume two will be out April 28th. So after that, sometime I will know.
Well, if you want some Sega Genesis games paired with Kung Fu movies, there's you can feel free to borrow liberally from the Geekade website.
Okay.
So for anybody who's listening to this isn't fully aware of exactly what your Super NES Omnibus entails, why don't you break that down?
Okay, so years ago, I started a series of books called the Classic Home Video Game Series over a decade ago. And that was going through each console with a console biography and then a sort of encyclopedia style review of each game, like a write up for each game. And so I started with Atari era up through the NES, up through the Sega Genesis and the systems that came out in 1989, classic home video games, 1989 through 90, referring to when the consoles came out, Sega Genesis, TurboGrafx, and Neo Geo. So that was the third book in the classic home video game series, possibly final. We'll see. I might do one with the 3DO and the JAG and the CDI, but we'll see. So the fourth book was going to be, the Super Nintendo was going to anchor that book because it came out in 1991 in America. And that was going to be the anchor of the classic home video games fourth volume in that series. And it was going to be paired up with the Atari Jaguar. Like I said, CDI and 3DO were going to be in there because those came out in the early 90s. But with the way things have gone, since 2006, when I started writing my first book that was professionally published, the retro gaming book market has changed considerably. The production values have gone way up. They're much more ubiquitous. You got full color photos. You got hardcovers, way different than it was 12 years ago. And so instead of doing another encyclopedia style book, like the classic home video games books with, you know, black and white photos and, you know, not that high a production, I switched publishers to Schiffer, which did the 100 greatest console video games, 1977 through 1987. They published my book, and that's full color, and I really like the production values, glossy paper, hardcover, et cetera, et cetera. And so I decided, with the popularity of the Super Nintendo and with the retro gaming book market the way it is now, I needed to go full-on Super Nintendo with, you know, hardcover, screenshots. And the first book of the two-volume set, the SNES Omnibus, the Super Nintendo and its Games, Volume 1, A through M, is every U.S. release, obviously from A to M, with a write-up of the game done by me, plus some quotes from different vintage magazines and from websites, just sort of giving you a more well-rounded look at the game other than just for me. That way you get some, you know, varied opinions. And then plus you have some fun facts and memories and things like that that I've contributed as well. But then plus, and the coolest part of the book, insider insights were like what you guys wrote, where people in the industry, YouTubers, reviewers, programmers, developers, bloggers, convention organizers, people in the involved professionally in the industry in one way or another, contributed stories to the book. Nostalgic stories programming the games, all night, you know, couch co-op, how a game maybe got through someone through a difficult time, like a death of a loved one. Had some pretty touching stories in here where in some cases people held on to, you know, sanity just by a particular game maybe they shared with that person they lost. You know, so there's, you know, the stories vary from funny to sad to crazy. You know, you got all kind of, and you got such a perspective of people, you know, people from their 20s, wrote about the games all the way to, you know, people even as old as me, you know, that grew up playing the Super Nintendo or whatever. And you've got everybody from Chris Kavanaugh, who published Classic Gamer magazine, Brittany Brombacker, you know, the blonde nerd. You've got Tim Lapatino, who wrote Art of Atari. You got filmmaker Rob McCallum. You got just a wide spectrum of contributors. Benjamin Reeves, the senior editor at Game Informer. John Riggs, a YouTuber. So all kinds of people contributed. Steve Wojta, I'm not sure how you say that, who, you know, has been programming all the way from the Atari days. You've even got one of the old Blue Sky Rangers that used to program for the Intellivision. So you've got a lot of, you know, varied accounts of playing specific Super Nintendo games. So around half of the games in here have an accompanying insider insight, which is just really in-depth stories of the times, you know, when you'd rent games at Blockbuster, you'd go to Toys R Us and you'd get that little slip and take it to the front, that magical building where, you know, the games are and systems and stuff you can get from there. So it's so you've got an encyclopedia style book, you know, with a reference of every game and a write-up of every game, but you've also got a lot of color commentary in the form of these stories. So it's a really well-rounded book as far as information and stories.
That's been probably my favorite part to read. I haven't made it through the entire book yet because it's a lot of book.
It's pretty massive.
It's a lot of book.
Yeah, it's a lot of book. I really enjoyed tracking down Dan's contributions because I didn't read them beforehand. I didn't even really know specifically all the games he did.
I am a brilliant writer.
Really genius.
I mean, stunning, staggeringly good stuff.
I would concur.
I tracked down Ferg, host of the Atari 2600 Game by Game podcast, friend of mine. He contributed, and I tracked down the ones that he wrote, and it's just been flipping through it and picking random games that I enjoy, and just it's been really fun looking at the what are other people's memories of these games that I love so much. And
Chris Baker that works for Marvel contributed some stories. Christopher Pico, the old ass retro gamer. Blake Harris, the author of Console Wars. So you got a lot of stuff in here. And I decided to so I worked with Pat Contry on his book, his NES book. And he, with each game, he has reflections, and those are, whoever wrote the review of the game or whatever would offer reflections. And I thought that was a neat idea, but I decided to do it differently. Instead of just having, reflections by these different writers, I decided to get all industry people involved, to contribute stories. So that's why. And some people said, well, why don't you want fan perspectives? And I said, well, that's fan perspectives are great, but with this particular project, I want it to be all industry professionals contributing the stories. Just to, I wanted my, the book to stand out and just to have something unique about it. And far and wide, I mean, that's people's favorite part of the book. Because you got the information. If you need to look up a game and figure out what it's about, you've got the information. But just pure entertainment value, everybody really loves the insider insights.
You hear that, Chris? We're professionals.
That's
indeed.
That's what I took away from there.
Yeah, I didn't know you worked with Pat in his book, because I was going to ask you about there seems to be a kind of a structural similarity between the two of the books, just on a basic skeletal level. And
So here's what happened. So Pat and I've known Pat since 2010, and the Screw Attack gaming convention. Outside of Dallas, or there were some in Dallas and some right outside of Dallas.
I always wanted to go to that con.
It was a crazy convention. It was Keith Apicary, Angry Video Game Nerd, Pat, Peanut Butter, Pro Jared. I had a lot of interesting guests, media guests, YouTubers and stuff, mostly YouTubers. And it was a fun show. It was crazy. It was definitely based on their website, because that's who would come. It didn't have that much of a mainstream outreach, mm-hmm. but people would fly from all over that loved that website would come to it. And so 2010, I go to the show and I meet Pat and we're talking and stuff, and I've got my books there, and he's looking at my NES book, Classic Home Video Games 1985 through 1988, which refers to the little console era, the systems that came out around that time. And he was looking at it and he was talking to me. He said, he had been thinking about, writing a Nintendo book, just the NES, every U.S. or he goes beyond U.S. releases. I don't recall off the top of my head. He's got a bunch of stuff in there. But anyway, he wanted to do an NES book, every NES game. And so I talked to him about that, and he was checking out my book, and he was saying he had something bigger in mind production value wise, screenshots, full color, every box and all that, or every cartridge, all that kind of stuff. And so we talked a while, and then sometime later he contacted me and asked me if I wanted to be involved in his book. And it was a paying market, and as a freelance writer, I'm always looking for paying markets and all that kind of stuff. And so we talked it over and went back and forth, and he told me his idea and his vision, and I said, yeah, I'm definitely on board. And so I would submit lists of games I was interested in doing that I had a lot of experience with and that I could write about. And so I ended up doing the third most amount of games in there. Pat obviously wrote the majority of them. And then his podcasting partner, Ian, wrote the second most, the largest number of write-ups and reflections in the book. And then I was third. I've got, but somewhere between 50 and 60 reviews and reflections in his NES guidebook, and it was a lot of fun. And one thing I discovered was Pat's a pretty good editor. He read my reviews and he would ask me a couple things. He'd want me to add some things and maybe get different perspectives, different gameplay elements, and so it was a good experience. And it's nice to be in that book because he's obviously very popular and has a big following. So having my name and bio in that book is a good thing. And so it was cool. So that's how that went. And that's part of the reason, you know, when it came time to do the next Classic Home Video Games book, I needed to go bigger, you know, bigger book, more photos, full color, hardcover, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, it's a super nice book. It is a, like I said before, it's freaking massive. And it was one of those things when I first saw it, I think you were at Too Many Games, right? You were sharing a table with Leonard Herman.
Yes.
I think that was the first time I actually saw the book. Me and Ferg actually walked up to the table and I was like, holy crap, this thing is so much bigger than I thought it was. Is there a soft cover version coming out? Cause I do know with a lot of these, game history books, they're super nice. They make great gifts and everything. And complete lunatics like me like to throw a lot of money at them. But there's also definitely a market for, you know, soft cover versions.
Sure.
That are considerably less expensive. Is that on the horizon for this?
Currently there's nothing, and I don't know if there will be one. My first book for Schiffer came out in 2014, The 100 Greatest Console Video Games, 1977 through 1987. That was a Schiffer hardcover, and it has yet to come out in softcover. And I've asked them about it, and they said once they get it sold well, but they still have a number of them in their warehouse. And I think once the sell through on that is a little more, maybe it'll come out in soft cover. And it's got, I don't know if you got, I'm sure you guys have seen it. It's got the sort of the NES cartridge cover.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice book.
Yeah, thanks. I've talked to, since a lot of games in it are Atari 2600, I've talked to Schiffer about if it does come out in paperback to do an Atari themed cover. Because I think some people, for the soft cover, and I think some people who bought it originally might buy it again just for the cool Atari cover. And of course I would add some stuff to it, you know, to kind of make it worth the while, maybe get a new forward by an Atari guy or something. Maybe one of the Atari programmers. I could see Gary Kitchen or somebody like that doing it. He's a really cool guy and is really interacts with the fans well. I've gotten to know him over the years and he really likes books, so I think he might be interested in doing something like that. But anyway, so I'm not sure if the SNES Omnibus, if they will ever be in paperback. It's possible, but at this point, it's hard to say.
I'm looking forward to Volume 2. I mean, you know, not just because I contributed to it, but it looks nice. I like the purple that you went with. You know, the red for the Volume 1 and the purple for the Volume 2.
I didn't know what they were going to do for Volume 2 design wise. I didn't know if they would come up with the blue just to contrast with the red, or but I'm glad that they went with the Super NES colors. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I think it'll look really, really nice on the shelf next to the Volume 1.
And there's a couple of different contributors for Volume 2 that weren't in Volume 1. One is Kelsey Lewin, the YouTuber, Seattle-based YouTuber that also is a co-author of Pink Gorilla Games up there. And she did a story about Packy and Marlin, about how that game turned her on to collecting strange and unusual systems.
That's where I know games. Her from. Yeah, I've seen her channel. She's got a lot of, right? She does like a lot of like videos about just super weird stuff. And
yeah, it's interesting. She's only in her mid-20s, but she's really, really mature, really, really smart. I've hung out with her some at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and she has family near in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So when she was here last year sometime, I think, we went to the National Video Game Museum and played the world's largest Pong machine and had a great time, went out to dinner and stuff. And she's just really, really cool, really intelligent, really mature, and really, really has a lot of depth of gaming knowledge for someone her age. I mean, she's really studied. If you like Norm, the gaming historian, mm-hmm. you should definitely watch Kelsey Lewin's videos. She knows her stuff.
I've watched a handful of them and been kind of astonished when, like, because when you first see her on a YouTube video, you think, you know, she's not going to know what she's talking about. She's reading a script. There's no way she knows this much. She's clearly like in her early 20s. But then she starts talking, you're like, this girl is legitimately saying these things. And that's
really fantastic. She's very, very knowledgeable. And like I said, she's a business owner. She and I talked to her about that. I said, you know, you're very intelligent. You know a lot about these games. You're very mature. You know, where does this come? You're very young. What's going on? And so her dad was an announcer with the Texas Rangers, who are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And she grew up around, you know, famous Major League Baseball players. She grew up around a lot of people around, moving from different cities and stuff. So just she had a lot of experiences like that as she grew up. So it just kind of helped her mature through the years, you know, and everything. So she's solid, man. She's really got her stuff together.
It's just astonishing to me how much stuff she's able to get. Like, I remember.
Yeah, she does her research. She takes her time. You know, she's not cranking out a video every other day. And there's a need for some of that, you know, because people like Sean Long do a great job of staying on top of the news. You know, mm-hmm. they'll cover topical things, you know, boom, 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 and that's great. But with her, you know, she deals with the history, and so her videos take a lot of time, and she really has to do a lot of research about this obscure stuff she covers.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing an article for Nintendo Force a while back about the Famicom network system, mm-hmm. the modem thing, and her video is actually where I got a lot of the information from. It's probably the most in-depth thing that I've seen about that particular piece of video game history was her video. But it's just astonishing looking at the things that she's done videos on, and it's
right.
Like, Of course, she has a sharp Nintendo TV. Like,
yeah, right. Well,
I've always wanted one of those darn things.
And you know, she's a big fan of the Wonder Swan, and at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, she bought the Super NES Life Cycle and all that strange and unusual gaming stuff she was in. It all started with getting Packy and Marlin on their Super Nintendo, and you can only read about that in the SNES Omnibus Volume 2, shipping April 28th.
Nice.
Good. Pre-orders are available.
Well done, plug.
Yes. Within context. So.
Yeah, no, that was excellent.
Well, currently, if you pre-order it, you get a free copy of my book of short stories, The Arcade and Other Strange Tales, and you get a free copy of Old School Gamer Magazine, number 5. So there are some early bird extras for anybody that wants to pre-order it.
Nice. In the interest of just mentioning cool YouTube channels that are mm-hmm. People who know their stuff, there's this channel that I've been getting a real kick out of called Retro Revisited. Every month he does a retro news roundup, and like these videos get like 200, 300 views, and I'm astonished that the view counts are so low, because it's like everything that happened in the retro gaming world wrapped up into these like 5 to 6 minute videos, and there's one every month. And whenever they come out, I'm just like, oh, this is awesome. And I mean, like, he touches on like, here's all the homebrew games that were made for the ZX Spectrum, and here's all the Arcade Archives Neo Geo games that came out for the PS4, like everything all wrapped up in these little just news bits, and they're really super good. The YouTube page is Retro Revisited. I want to reach out to the guy and see if I can get him on the show sometime next year, because I think he's fascinating, and I think these little videos are great. He's got a really good sense of humor. He fits at least one solid pun per video, which is really nice.
Shame when a really well done or a guy that makes really good videos, or someone that, you know, does quality material, just doesn't, for some reason, that just never takes off or just can't get the views.
I mean, I'm not even entirely sure how long he's been doing this stuff. It seems like he's got a pretty decent amount of stuff on his page. I mean, I'm looking at these retro news roundups that are going back to, oh boy, this just keeps going back to 2012. Jeez, he's been doing these since 2012. They're just solid stuff. I heartily recommend this guy's YouTube channel, Retro Revisited. 1,699 subscribers. You should be number 1,700.
I will be. Subscribe right now.
Oh, goodness gracious me. Well, let's see. What other questions did I have for you, sir? Like I said, I didn't really do a whole lot of prepping for this episode, because, you know, you're just a pretty easy guy to talk to.
Yeah, and we've certainly done enough BSing through so far.
Well, how about this? How about I read a short insider insight by one John Riggs?
Go for it.
All right. So he wrote, John Riggs, for people that don't know, he is appears on Metal Jesus' channel from time to time, pretty frequently. And he does like mods and repairs and things like that for video game systems. And he wrote, or cartridges or whatever. So he wrote an insider insight on Mario Paint. And this is in the SNES Omnibus Volume 1. And so here we go. It says, I thought Mortal Kombat was the most violent video game I would ever play. That was before my friends and I got a hold of Mario Paint. I'm not sure what drew me to the game, but I knew I had to have it the moment I heard about it. In the 80s, when I wasn't making flipbook animations, I had something called an Etch-a-Sketch Animator 2000, where you could animate a short story in pixel form. With Mario Paint, I was a little disappointed that you could only animate relatively few frames at a time. Still, thinking how creative I could get under these limitations, I decided to draw Link chopping with an axe with a blood spurt as the axe landed on the final frame on whatever it was cutting. I animated him chopping random objects from a human head to a pile of cats. To make it funnier, the soundtrack I provided was a happy tune that featured cats meowing. My friends and I were rolling on the floor laughing at our masterful creation. Their creativity was endless. I shudder to think what other people animated behind closed doors. So that's just one little snippet, you know, just one little insider insight. And he went the humorous route. And he, you know, grew up playing Mario Paint in a way that, you know, who knows how many people were making violent animations or you know, who, you know, what kind of creations they were making. So that's just one example of an insider insight.
I can tell you that one rings pretty true to me. I didn't do violent I did do violent animations. Bunch were all stick figures, though. Remember the one stick figure one I did with like two stick figures standing there, and then an anvil fell on the other one's head, and just blooded bits went everywhere. But the most fun I remember having was there was you could do a Super Mario World like coloring book thing. It was, you know, Mario on Yoshi's back is a big thing, and you could just spend time coloring it in. And I did the cutout tool where I just took Yoshi's head and took it off, flipped it upside down, put a knife in Mario's head, put spirals in his eyes, and just blood everywhere.
I'm sure that's what Nintendo had in mind when they created the Mario Paint.
I've spent a ton of time in Mario Paint. I mean, it was one of the ones that I saw was taken when you were showing all the games that were available, that I was kind of bummed that I couldn't write about, because God, that game was just insane. And I can't believe there's never been a proper follow up to it either, because
yeah, it'd be perfect for you know, it'd been great on the Wii U with that controller, and it, you know, now they should do something for the Switch. I mean, it would definitely, I think it would sell.
Absolutely. I mean, the Music Maker alone, people still do things with that Music Maker. There's like a modified version of it online, and people still make music with that Music Maker tool, which is ridiculous. But God, the amount of time I spent making music in Mario Paint and color and stuff, I actually busted out a few months ago for my son, and he thought it was the coolest thing. Just, you know, messing around with the mouse on the old CRT and whatnot.
Nice. That's cool.
So did you do any of the insider insight things?
When I would do it, I would call it memories, and just to distinguish it from the other. So anywhere in there where you see memories, it was just some of my memories playing the game. So
what were your in Volume 1? What were your favorite games from Volume 1?
Well, it's interesting. So a lot of people say, you know, we'll just automatically assume it's going to be Earthbound or Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, something like that. And those are definitely great and some of my favorites. One of my favorites is Donkey Kong Country. Absolutely love Donkey Kong Country. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, back in at that time period when the SNES was new, we would play Street Fighter II Turbo, and that started causing problems. Because she'd be Chun-Li, I'd be E Honda, and I was just 100 hand slapping the crap out of her, and no matter what character would play, I would just, she might win every once in a while, and I would even, you know, configure it where, you know, you could handicap the game, but she didn't want to have any of that. She's equal, you know, she's feminist, doesn't want it to be handicapped. Anyway, so that caused a lot of problems, because we just got too competitive, and it created a rift. Well, when Donkey Kong Country came out, that was the perfect game, because we could both play, and it's not really two-player simultaneous, but, you know, you can do the high five and go back and forth. And so
it's a really fun way to do co-op in that, yeah.
It really is. And if there's a particular section that she didn't want to go through because it was difficult or just lame or something, I would do it. Or if she just wanted to have fun going back and getting a bunch of extra lives in level one, she could do that, you know. So it was a great game to cooperate and beat together. And that was a blast. But my favorite all-time video game anywhere of any kind, any era, any system is Mr. Do. And because I just love the arcade game, and there's just so many strategies, and it's old school. I'm very old school. I love that you can dig your own mazes, and it's just got the extra, the special, and the different ways, or the extra where you can, you know, win lives and stuff. And sorry, I'm so tired. I just love that game because, you know, if you get all the cherries in succession, you know, you get extra points, you know, without skipping one. If you kill the monsters a certain way, if you drop an apple and a whole bunch at once, you know, there's just so many strategies. I absolutely love that game. And I'm a big fan of old genres, you know, climbing games, maze games, mm-hmm. 2D shooters, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm a big fan of Mr. Do, and I love the Super Nintendo version, not only because it's a great translation, but also because it's got a two-player battle mode, and it's a blast. Mm. You know, you can shoot each other, or you can agree to cooperate, kind of like original Mario Brothers. You can agree mm-hmm. to progress in the game as long as you can, or you can just sabotage each other if you want, and it's great. So people look at me funny when I tell them my favorite all-time Super Nintendo game is Mr. Do, you know, because there's so many phenomenal games on the system. But also, you know, I think as far as just the Super Nintendo in general, big fan of the Super Star Wars trilogy. And, of course, that'll be in Volume 2. Yeah, those are difficult. You know, they're
brutally difficult. I've never beaten any of them.
Me neither. Just make you freaking pull your hair out. With Super Star Wars, I remember walking around Walden Books or going to Walden Books to look at the strategy guide and write some of the cheats down because, you know, I didn't want to buy the book. I just wanted, you know, some codes to skip levels because it was such a freaking hard game.
And, and any of you youngins listening, Walden Books used to be a bookstore.
Yeah, in the malls. I used to actually work at Walden Books. As a matter of fact, I quit. Yeah, I worked there. So I used to own in the 1989, I was a manager at a comic book store. And then in 91, my brother-in-law and I teamed up to open a couple of comic book stores in the Fort Worth area. And then after that, after I sold my share of the business to him, I took some time off and I played Tetris for the NES for 3 months. And I got to the point where when I would drive into downtown Fort Worth, I would start seeing pieces fall down out of the sky to fit the buildings. So I thought, okay, I've been playing a little too much Tetris. It's time to get back to work. And so I got a job at Walden Books and worked there several years. And then in like 1997, I started writing for the All Game Guide, which used to be at allgame.com. They were tied in with the All Movie Guide and the All Music Guide, which are still around. But the All Game Guide, I worked for that for several years as a contributor, reviewer, and editor. So I was able to quit Walden Books to write full time based on the All Game Guide work, plus some other writing I was doing. I worked at Walden Books for several years before quitting to write full time, and it was a cool job. It was something I wanted to do. I've always been a avid reader and like books, so that was cool.
So just to go back to the comic book thing, was mm-hmm. what drove you to open a comic book store? Are you a big comic book fan, or was it just
I grew up absolutely loving Marvel and DC comics. And you know, the big superheroes. Big fan of the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Daredevil, and Iron Man, Captain America, Flash, Green Lantern, Superman, Batman, all the major heroes from Marvel and DC. I just absolutely loved, and it was always a dream of mine to open a comic book store. And when I got old enough, and my brother-in-law is 8 years older than me, or 10 years older than me, and he married my sister when I was only like 11 or 12 years old. And I thought he was just the coolest person ever because he was into comics, and he gave me his King Kong, the movie cards when they got married, and he gave me a bunch of comics and Star Trek books and Kiss magazines and all this stuff. And I just always thought, wow, a grown-up likes all this stuff. This is awesome. And so we were pretty tight for years. I mean, we'd play the NES, ColecoVision together and all this stuff anytime they'd come over. And so we were really tight and would go to comic conventions and whatnot. We started doing baseball card shows on the weekends to raise capital to open a comic book store. And this was around the time when the speculator boom.
Yeah.
And before the speculator boom and before baseball cards and comic books were so intertwined, we were doing baseball card shows to raise money to open the comic book store. And people thought we were prescient or some kind of, you know, predictors of the future, because we were selling baseball cards with comics before pretty much anybody else was. But we were only doing it because we saw an easy way to make a lot of money with the baseball cards. And we did that specifically to fund the comic book store business. But people thought we were just ahead of the curve somehow, on purpose, you know, having the baseball cards and the comics together. And I guess in some ways we were, but we were mainly using it as a utilitarian means to open a comic book store. And so, yeah, that was in 91, I believe, was our first store. And we expanded. We had a huge store in the Fort Worth area. It was doing great. And we opened a second store in South Fort Worth, a smaller store. And so we had two stores. We had Adam West sign autographs in our store. We were part of the Marvel Mega Tour, where we were one of five stores in North Texas picked to be in this big Marvel convention in Dallas one weekend, in like 93 or 4. And that was a big deal because we got it. My girlfriend, my wife now, we got to have dinner with Stan Lee and Clive Barker. And
nice.
Yeah, it was very cool. This Mexican restaurant in Arlington. And the night before the convention, Friday night before the big Marvel convention, because Stan Lee and Clive Barker were the big, you know, key guests at that convention that weekend. And it was great. I mean, just five retail locations with free, you know, we didn't have to pay to be involved in this. We were just there selling Marvel product. And so it was a great deal for us. And I don't think we had the bad. I don't remember that part anyway. Not important, but it was a great show and a lot of fun. And then just over time, my brother-in-law had our differences, and we just decided to go our separate ways. And I sold my share of the business to him, and then he kept it going for a while until the big comic book crash, you know, after the speculator boom was over. And so, yeah, and then after that was when I played Tetris for 3 months and then started working at Walden Books.
Do you still read comics?
I don't buy the new stuff. It's expensive and it's hard to keep up with. And so I don't mess with the new stuff too much. Sometimes I'll still go in the comic shop just to kind of see what's going on. But I'll still read the occasional graphic novel or just look at some of my old comics. And strangely enough, you know, with writing, it's pretty intensive mentally. And so at the end of the day, or just when I'm chilling out, a lot of times I'll just read like Richie Rich or Archie, you know, just to have something fun to read. Yeah, just a good way to relax. You know, I'll find them for a quarter or 50 cents a piece at comic shops. I mean, at comic conventions. I still go to conventions a lot because I'll cover them for the newspaper or just for fun or to buy stuff to resell at my – I've got an antique booth where I sell pop culture stuff, so I'll reload at conventions and stuff. So I still go to those and to interview celebrities or to do whatever. And, most of my comic book reading now is just older stuff.
I like Ninja Turtles.
Are cool.
I used to work at a comic book store too. I've always been a comic book guy, but IDW has been doing a run of Ninja Turtles for the last several years, and it's been astonishingly high quality ever since
really?
It started. It's
that's cool.
It's the best iteration of Turtles that's ever been. It pulls.
Wow,
from all
I didn't
the
even know that.
Technologies. It's so smart. It's so good. It's exactly
it's
what it
excellent.
Should be.
Excellent.
Really wow, is. I had no clue.
Yeah, it's as good for different reasons, but it is as good as the Eastman Laird stuff.
Wow.
And Eastman's on the book too. And honestly, like the Eastman Laird stuff was kind of all over the map, but you know, going back and rereading it now, it's like some of this is really cool, some of this is kind of stupid, but I mean, it's Ninja Turtles, you know. There's
I still have my Eastman and Laird's TMNT collected book volume one, from published by Mirage, and that covers the Mirage first.
Yeah,
I still have that, and that was, I remember reading that and thinking it was good.
Yeah, I like, and I loved all that old like independent comic stuff, like, because I read the mainstream stuff, but I was always like, you know, big into like Hate. I thought was just brilliant.
Oh, dude. And, like, Hate is one of my favorite comics of all time.
It's phenomenal. Like,
it's just brilliant.
Just phenomenal stuff. And like James O'Barr's like original Crow book was incredible. Mm-hmm. And like just all of that stuff. So like this new Turtles book is, it doesn't feel like it could have come out in that era, but it has the sort of like the creativity and the fearlessness that those like old independent books had.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good.
Very cool.
Yeah. If you have even the slightest reverence for the Ninja Turtles, like,
yeah,
check out volume one of the book and just see the way that they do it. Cause yeah, collecting and then trade paperbacks is really the way to go. I mean, I still get it issue by issue cause I'm a whore. But
yeah,
honestly, right. The only books I'm still getting to these, back when I was working at the comic book store, I was getting a lot of stuff, you know, I got a pretty decent discount on the books at the time, but sure. I've had to cut back on so many things. Like I tried keeping up with X-Men, but at that point I was reading X-Men Blue, X-Men Gold, and X-Men Red was coming out, and Astonishing X-Men. And I only have so many dollars to contribute to buying books. So I'm only reading Ninja Turtles and all of the Ninja Turtles spinoffs and just the main Star Wars book, which has also been really solid.
Cool.
The Marvel Star Wars has been really good. Right. Wish I had more time to read more comics, but I digress.
I understand completely.
Well, here we are pretty much, we're coming up towards where Dan and I would usually start realizing how tired we are, but we have a couple of minutes left. There are a few things happening in the world of video games. I guess I wouldn't mind getting your take on.
Okay, sure.
Something that's been in a lot of the news lately is the whole Bethesda bag situation. Have you heard about this?
Bethesda bag situation?
Right, so Fallout 76, there was like some sort of fancy collector's edition that had a bag. It was supposed to be a canvas bag, and then
I heard something about that, but haven't really followed it too closely. I know the game had, a lot of people have been complaining about the game.
Yeah, folks aren't too keen on exactly what this game is.
Mm-hmm.
So the collector's edition was supposed to have this nice looking canvas bag, and then they sent out the collector's edition, and they were these like super cheap nylon bags.
Okay, right.
And
that's ringing a bell now.
People are super pissed about it, especially because a lot of like YouTube personalities and influencers, they got the canvas bag that they advertised. And then Bethesda was like, their official statement on it was something like, yeah, those were expensive, so we did this instead.
Wow.
So we didn't.
So F you.
So I guess since you hadn't really heard much about this, I was just kind of curious what everyone in the room, i.e. you and Dan, what's your take on that is?
I am not surprised at all. Bethesda seems to get this like a pass from a lot of people for not being a giant corporation. But they're a giant corporation and they do giant corporation things. You know what I mean? Like they're not as bad as EA, but I mean, they're kind of equivalent, right?
I don't know. I don't follow Bethesda all that much, to be honest with you. I mean, Doom was the first game of theirs that I've played. I think ever the recent Doom,
but I mean, like
it's software than Bethesda.
And you and I we've talked about it on the show a bunch of times, how Bethesda games are just like the reason we don't follow and we're not that up on it. It's because they're just not really for us. Like Morrowind was never on my radar. I tried Skyrim and was like, whatever. Fallout feels like a game I should love, but I just don't. You know, so I'm not shocked that a company promised something and then was like, "Man, fuck you." Have this instead.
Brett, do you play any Bethesda games at all?
No, I don't do a ton of modern gaming. You know, I beat the newest Mario game on the Switch, and I played a little bit of Zelda, and I've just recently, you know, like I mentioned before, recently been playing some PlayStation 4, and I have a 360 that I played some, you know, but there's a lot of modern stuff that I just don't get into for lack of time and investment. You know, if I go into my game room and I'll typically gravitate towards the older stuff, you know, just as a matter of course.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like simpler games. I mean, Spider-Man stretched the limits on what I like as far as complexity goes. You know, there's just so many controls and options and, you know, things to acquire and maps and all that. And that's fine. It works great. And it was pretty simple to understand. But much beyond that, then I'm out, you know. And I'm not a huge FPS.
You haven't picked up Red Dead Redemption?
We actually have that. My son has it. I did play the first one for a while, and I got stuck on a scene, and so I kind of put it down. But I haven't played the new one, but my son's been enjoying it.
It's so funny you mentioned that. I was in Best Buy earlier today, and I was behind a woman who was returning a copy of Red Dead Redemption because she was not under the impression that this cowboy game was going to be quite so violent and just you know, nasty-ish. And
yeah, I mean, having the big M on there probably didn't help. Yeah.
Well, she was comparing it to the old West.
They were pretty crude back then.
Yeah. That was the thing. She was comparing it to Grand Theft Auto. She's like my kids played Grand Theft Auto, and like, yeah, that's kind of like super awful, but it's like put in this specific perspective. But this cowboy game, like, I expected it to just be like, you know, a John Wayne movie or something. Yeah, no, it wasn't like that at all.
I think that's super racist.
more Sergio Leone than John Wayne.
Yeah, right.
So she's having this conversation with the guy behind the counter, and then I go and pick up my pre-order for Monster Boy, and I was like, this game is more my speed. And I played like 15 minutes of it tonight before the show. I hadn't had a chance to play it all day because I work and have tiny children, but God, it's so cool. I'm just in love with it already. It's just wonderful. And I love Wonder Boy, the Dragon's Trap for Master System.
And, yeah.
And I thought the remake was absolutely brilliant. And this is, like I said, I'm only like 15 minutes in, but it's a great little spiritual successor to that.
Yeah. I've heard a friend of mine, he loves that game.
It's Monster Boy came out today. Now this episode's going live on Friday, the day Smash comes out. So, unfortunately, Smash Brothers is probably going to bury just about everything else on the Switch. But
well, people can listen to this podcast while they play Smash.
Exactly,
that's true.
And then they can go out and get Monster Boy and Katamari, which are both out on Switch this week, and are both very well deserving of your dollars.
Monster Boy is also out on PS4.
Yes, Monster Boy's on everything: PS4, Xbox One, and Switch. Coming to PC next year. Katamari is oddly a Switch exclusive. Like, as a Nintendo junkie, that's kind of cool to me, but it's also super confusing because, like, it's a remake of it's a remaster of the original Katamari for PS2, which is a brilliant game, but it's been only on PlayStation 2. Like, that specific game is only a PS2 game. Now it's only a Switch game with a PC as well, but weird. A series of strange decisions revolving around that game. I wrote a whole blog post about it that's going to go up tomorrow, just about, you know, why are they releasing this game on the same day as Smash? Why is the demo only in Japan? Why is the physical version seemingly only at GameStop? Like, these very strange decisions being made around this, what should be a relatively large release, I would think.
Right.
All right. Another thing that's been that came up in the news. You mentioned Blake Harris earlier. Console Wars is being turned into a TV series from Legendary.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Well, if I recall correctly, it's been a while since I've read it, but it was kind of written in a like a narrative form as far as
It was very,
you know,
much
for
like...
As far as nonfiction goes, it was written in more narrative form than most, so I think it would translate well. As much as any nonfiction book would, I suppose.
Yeah, I was so in love with this book. I really enjoyed it, and especially like I said before, I'm a huge Nintendo guy, and this was largely from Tom Kalinske's Sega perspective. So it was really, really interesting take on it. We just talked about this. I do a TV podcast for the website as well called This Week's Episode. And this was one of the news stories we talked about. And I just kind of flipped my lid over how excited I am to see this be turned into a series. Now, Dan, you read this book too, right?
I did. It was really good. And there's a cool story to tell there.
Yeah, exactly. Take all the video game minutiae out of it. It's still just a really cool story about industry and
Clash of Titans.
Yeah,
exactly. Very David and Goliath to begin with, and then turns into a Clash of Titans, which is pretty cool. Right.
And hopefully there won't be too much creative liberty taken to make it more dramatic than it needs to be or anything like that. Like, because it is an interesting story and it's a good story. You can see kind of the groundwork for a path to absurdity through,
it's got to have more pixelated bullshit in it, like that fucking Adam Sandler movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's the potential for that sort of hogwash, as it were. But like, if they do it just like as a straight adaptation of the story, there's something cool there.
I couldn't agree more. I'm stoked for it. I can't wait to see what it actually turns into, because they've been talking about it making it into a movie for the longest time. And that's always kind of left me a little shaky, because from what I had read about it, it was going to have like all these, documentary bits spliced in between the telling of the actual story. And it just seemed like a really weird choice. But I feel like this book being adapted as a TV series, I think, makes a bit more sense.
Yeah.
Well, and Legendary Pictures is usually pretty good about what they put out. Like, they put out cool, interesting stuff, and they don't really go, like, I wouldn't say that there's any Legendary Pictures products that I've been like, well, that was a bit much. like, they usually have a decent amount of respect for the source material.
That's good to hear. Speaking of respect for source material, Dan brought this to my attention. Negan from The Walking Dead is in Tekken. It's in Tekken.
I'm kind of super excited about it. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever that Jeffrey Dean Morgan would be a playable character in the new Tekken.
But using his voice, does he voice the character?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, at least in the trailer that they showed, the lines were right from the show. I assume I haven't watched that show in a long time. But
it kind of sucks now.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. But the idea, like, if in your head you go, Negan is a downloadable character in Tekken 7, it's like, that's a little weird. But if you switch that to Jeffrey Dean Morgan is a downloadable character in Tekken 7, it becomes a way better value proposition.
I guess I didn't look at it from that perspective.
I mean, because really, how many more times are you going to get to say a weird-ass sentence like that and have it be true?
In the game, is he just going to talk your ear off and then hit somebody with a bat every once in a while?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, he does have Lucille, and like his... The actual way he controls and fights looks pretty cool and interesting. Like, if I had Tekken, I would get it.
Yeah, I was about to say, if I'm playing that game, it wouldn't be too long till I pick him as a playable character. It'd be very my selection for sure. I'd be curious.
And like, what was it? Mortal Kombat that had like Freddy and Jason and Leatherface and shit and Mike Myers. And I mean, like, there's certainly precedent for that sort of thing to be in there. Plus, I mean, it's Tekken. It's not necessarily the most realistic thing in the world.
It's just one of those things where, like, I mean, I feel like if it's a fighting game and it's some weirdo crossover like Smash Brothers, they should probably be like a fighter to some degree and not just some dude with a spiky baseball bat and no morals.
Well, I mean,
face off against Hayashi, and Hayashi's going, like, Hayashi couldn't care less about his baseball bat. He's freaking Hayashi. He's just going to straight up destroy the guy.
It does make more sense for Negan to be in Tekken 7 than it made for Hayashi to be in Soul Calibur.
I guess that's technically true.
Negan should have been in fucking Soul Calibur. That would have been great.
You know what? I would have swallowed that one better because, you know, at least he's fighting with a weapon. You know, that makes sense. That at least lines up to me to a certain degree. I mean, that's a level of absurdity I could get behind, is Negan fighting a friggin' samurai or a ghost pirate, you know?
I kind of really want to see Negan Cervantes now, like that.
Hey, it's nearly Halloween.
Hey, you're on that webpage.
I am the 1,700th subscriber.
Well done, Brett.
Excellent.
Yes. No, seriously, I think you really dig those videos.
Cool.
All right, you know what? I think the only other thing I wanted to mention was the PlayStation Classic, but I don't think we all need to jump on the bandwagon waiting on that poor thing, right?
From what I understand, it's pretty bad. There's a mediocre selection of some of the games, and it's really bad emulation, and it's too expensive at $100, etc. But it seems like that's getting a lot of negative attention.
Yeah, the news story I saw today was that the debug menu was accessible in it.
Well,
you can actually mess with the emulation and stuff. You can also very easily brick the thing by using it, but it's like a certain kind of USB keyboard you can plug into it, and then you can just access the debug menu that they didn't take out or anything like that. It's just
that thing shipping, like it was so. And Sony has done a lot right for a long time now, but that is so obviously well, we're going to put out this version, and then we're going to put out the version with the dual analog sticks, and it's going to be like, that should have been the one that came from the get-go.
Right.
Like, not having the dual analog sticks on there means you don't have Metal Gear Solid. It means you don't have Ape Escape.
It does have Metal Gear Solid.
Does it? It should. Yeah.
It has Metal Gear Solid, and it's got the screenshot of Meryl's codec on the back of the system box.
All right, never mind. You should all buy it. I take back every negative thing I was going to say.
I still have my original PlayStation 1 hooked up with a flip top, hooked up because there are about 8 or 10 titles on the PS2 that aren't forward compatible with the PS2. So I still have my PS1 hooked up so I can play. There's like an arcade compilation that has Smash TV that won't play on the PS2. And there's a few other games that I still, I just like having it out. So I've got a lot of old consoles set up in my game room, and PS1 is one of them, and I've got all the games I need for it. So I don't figure I need a PS1 classic, regardless of how good or bad it is.
Yeah, that's fair.
I didn't know there were any titles that weren't backwards compatible on the PS2.
Yeah, there's probably about 8 or 10, and one of them is Arcade Party Pack.
That was the original reason
I kept my PS1 plugged in. I don't know. That works great with the dual shot.
I've got a computer that has no issues with compatibility. So, I mean, it's hard to make that argument when like the SNES Classic and the NES Classic were really nice pieces of hardware, and they look really cool, and they do some really nice things. And at like $50-$60, it's like, okay, there's some justification there. I don't see the justification for the PS1 Classic. I just really fail to see buying that thing.
Right.
And I have my backwards compatible PS3 hooked up, and that's where I do all my PS1, PS2, and PS3 gaming from time to time is on that thing. Though I do like to occasionally just break out the PlayStation 1 itself, because I do have PS1s and PS2s all locked up in my closet because I have small children and they'll destroy everything that I put on a shelf they can reach.
Sure.
But there's just nothing quite like turning on that PlayStation 1 and hearing that sound, you know.
At this point it's very nostalgic, and it was just such a adult cutting edge system at the time, you know, that really, really made it feel, it gave gaming a sophistication it lacked before the PS1 did.
Yeah. As much as I adore Nintendo, always have and always will, like their systems were always, you know, toys to an extent.
Yeah.
Like there was always certain, you know, you turn on a GameCube and there's nothing classy about that. Doobie 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 doobie. It gets adorable and it's awesome, but it's still kind of goofy. You know, you're still plugging in this purple box.
PS1 was like picking up a Sandman graphic novel as opposed to, you know,
Yes.
Maybe exactly. Nintendo was like grabbing a Superman or Spider-Man comic or something.
Exactly. That is well done. You should be a writer, Brett.
It's not getting better than that, Chris.
No, it's not getting better than that. So,
well, I've enjoyed it, guys. This has been great. It's always
thank
fun to talk
you.
To y'all.
It's always fun having you on.
You are wonderful.
So let's see. Let's do the plugs one last time. Brett, list everything that you need to list. Tell everyone where they can buy your books, where they should buy your books, and all your info.
Okay, so if you go to brettweisswords.com, brettweisswords.com, you can find links to all my books where you can buy them direct from me. You can also advance order the SNES Omnibus Volume 2 N through Z, which is loaded down with industry folks writing about memories of their favorite games and sometimes least favorite. And my best-selling book at this point is the 100 Greatest Console Video Games 1977 through 1987, where I take a look at the Atari, ColecoVision, early years of the NES. That's a book that everybody seems to enjoy. I've also got the classic home video game series. If you like fiction, you like The Twilight Zone, you like The Outer Limits, that kind of stuff, I've got a book of short stories called The Arcade and Other Strange Tales. If you're a rock music fan, if you like Kiss, I wrote a book called The Encyclopedia of Kiss. It's the world's first encyclopedia on the band. You can find all that stuff at brettweisswords.com.
Outstanding. And with that, that's going to be our show. Thank you very much for listening. Join us next week when we'll be talking about our favorite video game crossovers. No, maybe. Really, we're going to do it this time.
Nope. I'm not going to.
We've been talking about doing this crossover episode for like 2 months now. It just keeps getting pushed back. But no, seriously, we're going to do it. I think I mean it this time.
Nope.
Once again, you can get in touch with us at mail@geekade.com, as well as all flavors of social media that we inhabit. You can like us on Facebook, find us on Instagram at Geekade, subscribe to our YouTube and Twitch channels for all our latest video content, follow us on Twitter at @_Geekade, or find us individually on Twitter. I'm at Geekade Chris, that's Geekade KRIS. Dan, where can people find you?
At Geekade Dan.
And Brett, are you on Twitter?
At Brett Weiss, CHVG.
Look at that. If you're interested in more information about anything we discussed here tonight, be sure to check out our show notes. And while you're at it, you can also subscribe to this and any of our other wonderful podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher. Or if you're super nice, you can leave us a review, because any and all feedback is welcome and appreciated. We'd also like to thank our intrepid editor, Evan, for making the show listenable for all you folks. And we'd like to thank Mark TDK Knight for our show's theme. You can check him out on SoundCloud and Bandcamp, or his website, which we have a link to in the show notes. Again, always remember to keep your eyes on Geekade.com for even more fresh, original content. That is it, everybody. On behalf of Dan, Brett, and myself, keep playing games.